One cow went down, hit by a fragment. The others leaped and began to run. They ran away from the sound and straight toward Turl. Turl leveled the blast rifle.
"Those hoofs are moving," he said, "so you won't think it's an accident."
The bulls were coming on in a headlong rush, the cows behind them. The ground shook. The distance was closing quickly. Turl began to fire in quick single shots. He broke the legs of the following cows and they tumbled to earth, bawling. He broke the right front leg of the farthest bull. The other was almost upon them. One final shot and Turl broke the right front leg of the nearest bull, which skidded to a crumpled heap mere feet in front of them. The air was shattering with the bawls of pain from the cattle. Turl grinned as he looked at them. Johnny looked back at him in horror. That grin behind the faceplate was of pure joy. Johnny felt revulsion for the monster. Turl was... Johnny suddenly realized there was no word for cruel in the Cyclo language. He turned toward the cattle. Walking out in front with his kill club to put them out of their agony, he heard a new sound, a rustling rumble. Johnny whirled. Coming away from the cave, awakened and angered by all the racket, charging straight at Turl's back, was the biggest grizzly bear Johnny had ever seen. "Behind you!" he yelled. But his voice was drowned in the bawling of the cattle. Turl just stood there grinning. A moment later, the bear roared. Turl heard it and started to turn, but he was too late. The grizzly hit him in the back with an impact that sent out a shock wave. The blast rifle, driven from Turl's paws, soared into the air toward Johnny. He caught it in his left hand. But Johnny wasn't thinking of the blast rifle as any more than a club, and he had his own kill club up and striking before the bear could aim a second blow at Turl. The kill club caught the grizzly square on the brain pan. The bear staggered, distracted and stunned. Johnny sailed in again. The bear struck out with a massive clawed blow. Johnny went under it. The kill club hit again on the brain pan. The bear reared up and struck at the kill club as it came in again. The thong snapped. Johnny grasped the rifle by the barrel. The grizzly came at him with gaping jaws. The rifle stock crashed into the bear's teeth. Johnny struck again on the brain pan. With a dwindling roar, the bear went down. It stayed down, its limbs twitching in death. Johnny backed up. Turl was lying on his side, conscious. His mask was in place. His eyes behind the faceplate were wide and staring. Johnny backed up farther. Thank God the leash hadn't caught on anything and tripped him during the fight. He snapped the leash to him. Then he turned his attention to the gun. It had little labels on its controls. The safety catch was off. There was a charge under the trigger. It was scratched, but not otherwise damaged. Johnny looked at Turl. Turl looked back, his claws flexing and unflexing, waiting. He was certain the animal would level the gun and kill him. His paw stole down to his belt gun. If Johnny saw the movement toward the belt gun, he ignored it. He turned his back on Turl. He located the sights of the blast rifle and then, with six shots, put the crippled cattle out of their misery. Johnny put on the safety catch. He reached into his pouch and got a piece of sharp-edged glass and walked over to the bear and began to skin it. Turl lay and looked at him. At length, he realized he had better check himself out. A pain in his back, a rip in his collar, a bit of green blood on his paw. He tested his back. It was nothing serious. He went over to the car and sat down on a seat with the doors open and hunched there, still looking at Johnny.
"You're not going to carry that hide inside this car," said Turl.
Johnny didn't look up from his skinning.
"I'll lash it on top."
At length, Johnny bundled up the hide and went over to the youngest cow. Working deftly with the sharp glass, he took out the tenderloin and tongue, cut a haunch, and wrapped them in the bear hide. Johnny took some thongs from his pouch and lashed the hide with its meat to a gun mount on the car top. Then he handed the blast rifle to Turl.
"The safety is on," he said.
He was cleaning himself up with handfuls of grass. Turl looked at him.
Fear?
Fear be damned. This animal had no fear in him.
Leverage. It had to be leverage. Lots of it.
Get in, said Turl. It's getting late.
8. The following day, Turl was again a blur of activity. He was getting ready for another interview with Numpf. He rushed about doing mutiny interviews, recording each one on a type of tape that could be cut and spliced. It was a very artful task, requiring the greatest care. He approached numbers of employees on the job, inside the compound and out. The interviews went very smoothly and rapidly. Turl would ask,
"What company regulations do you know concerning mutiny?"
The employees, sometimes startled, always suspicious, would quote what they knew or thought they knew concerning mutiny. The security chief would then request,
"In your own words, tell me your opinion of mutiny."
The employees would, of course, get long-winded and reassuring.
"Mutiny is a very bad thing. Executives would cause vaporizations wholesale, and no one would be safe. I sure never intend to advocate or take part in any mutiny."
The interviews went on and on through the day. Turl rushing about, mask on outside, mask off inside. Recording, recording, recording. He always wound up an interview, shaking his head and smiling and saying it was just routine, and they knew how it was with management being what it was, and he, Turl, was on the employee's side. But he left a bit of worry in his wake, employees vowing to themselves to have nothing whatever to do with any mutiny, pay cut or no pay cut. From time to time, passing through his office, Turl would look at the image of the cage where the high-button cameras still performed their guard duty. Curiosity and a vague unease made him keep checking. The animal seemed very industrious. It had been up with first light. It had worked and worked, scraping the bear hide clean, and had taken old ashes and worked them into it. The hide was now hanging, pinned to the bars. Then the fire had been built up, and an odd network of branches, sort of racks, had been made around the fireplace. The beef was cut into long, thin strips and hung on the racks near the fire. Leaves from the chopped-up trees kept being put on the fire, creating a great deal of smoke, and the smoke was winding around the meat. Turl could not quite make out what the animal was really doing, but toward the end of the day he thought he knew. The animal was observing some kind of religious ritual having to do with spring. He had read something about this in the Chinko guidebooks. They had dances and other silly things. The smoke was supposed to carry the spirits of slain animals to the gods. Yesterday, they had certainly slain enough animals. The thought of it made Turl's back twinge. He had never believed any of these earth creatures could actually hurt a cyclo, but that grizzly bear had shaken his confidence slightly. It had been an awfully big bear. It weighed almost as much as Turl himself. Probably come sunset, the animal down there in the cage would build the fire up and begin to dance or something. He concluded it wasn't up to anything dangerous, and kept on with his headlong interviewing. That night, the recreation hall saw nothing of Turl. And he also forgot to see whether the animal danced. He was too busy with his tapes. Working with an expertise only a trained security chief cherished, Turl was editing tapes, slicing out single words and even phrases and juggling them about. By his readjusting of word positions and scrapping of whole paragraphs, employees began to say things on the reels that were building up that could hang them. A typical answer would become, "I intend to advocate mutiny. In any mutiny, it would be safe to vaporize executives." It was painstaking work, and the reels built up. Finally, he copied them onto new, clean disks that would show no sign of editing or splicing, and with the east graying, he sat back, finished. Yawning, he puttered around, cleaning up, destroying the originals and the scraps, waiting for breakfast time. He realized he had forgotten to keep an eye on the animal to see whether it danced. Turl decided he needed sleep more than breakfast and laid himself down for a short nap. His appointment with Numph was not until after lunch. Later, he was to tell himself that it was because he had missed both breakfast and lunch that he made the blunder. The interview began well enough. Numph was sitting at his upholstered desk, sucking at an after-lunch saucepan of Kerbango. He was his usual bumbling self.
"I have the results of the investigation you requested,"
Turl began.
"What?"
"I interviewed a lot of local employees."
"About what?"
"Mutiny."
Numph was immediately alert. Turl put the disc player on Numph's desk and made ready to play the interviews, saying,
"These are all very secret, of course. The employees were told that no one would hear about it, and they did not know the interviews were recorded."
"Wise, wise," said Numph.
He had laid the saucepan aside and was all attention. Turl let the discs spin one after another. The effect was everything he had hoped for. Numph looked grayer and grayer. When the discs were finished, Numph poured himself a saucepan full of Kerbango and sucked it down in one whoosh. Then he just sat there. If ever he had seen guilt, Turl decided, he was seeing it now. Numph's eyes were hunted.
"Therefore," said Turl, "I advise that we keep all this secret. We must not let them know what each is actually thinking, for it would lead them to conspire and actually mutiny."
"Yes," said Numph.
"Good," said Turl. "I have prepared certain papers and orders about this."
He put the sheaf on Numph's desk.
"The first one is an order to me to take what measures I deem necessary to handle this matter."
"Yes,"
Numph said and signed it.
"The second one is to strip all arsenals of all mine sites and keep all weapons under lock and key."
"Yes,"
said Numph, and signed it.
"This next one is to retrieve any battle planes from other mine sites and localize them under seals, except those I might need."
"Yes,"
said Numph, and signed it. Turl removed that which had been signed and left Numph staring at the next one.
"What's this?"
"Authority to round up and train man-animals on machine operation, so that company ore shipments can be kept rolling in event of deaths of company employees or refusals to work."
"I don't think it's possible," said Numph.
"It's only a threat to force employees back to work. You know, and I know, it is not really feasible."
Numph signed it doubtfully, and only because it said, "Emergency plan, strategic alternative ploy. Objective, employee dissuasion from strike." And then Turl made his blunder. He took the signed authorization and added it to the rest.
"It permits us to handle forced reduction of employees," he commented.
Afterward, he realized he need not have said a thing.
"Oh,"
said Numph.
"And I am sure,"
Turl had gone on, confirming his blunder,
"I am very certain that your nephew Knipe would heartily approve of it."
"Approve of what?"
"Reduction of employee numbers,"
Turl rattled on. And then Turl saw it. There was a relieved look on Numph's face, a knowing look, a look of realization that gave Numph great satisfaction. Numph gave Turl an almost amused glance. Relief seemed to soak into him. Confidence took the place of fear.